If you bring up the idea that America began as a Christian nation, some people will say, oh, no, it did not. Look at the Treaty of Tripoli. What's that? Well, we're going to talk about that right now with Dr. Peter Lilbeck, the president and the founder of Providence Forum, providenceforum.org. I'm Jerry Newcomb. And Dr. Lilbeck, so great to have you back in the studio here.
Thank you, Dr. Newcomb. It's been a real joy to do these interviews through the past several months.
All right. I remember that People for the American Way, which is really more like People for Norman Lear's Way, but anyway, they had a TV commercial, and they showed in this commercial, they were trying to make the point that America never was a Christian nation, and we should never say that it was. And they said that George Washington, and they said George Washington, not John Adams, George Washington supposedly signed the Treaty of Tripoli, which said that America is not and never was a Christian nation, or something to that effect. What are your thoughts?
Okay, well, let's, before we go back to the Treaty of Tripoli, let's go back to the Holy Trinity Church case of the Supreme Court in the late 1800s. They actually say America is a Christian nation. The Supreme Court, many years after Washington, were willing to say that.
Yep.
Whether we want to say it's accurate or not, they saw the evidence was there. So the first thing we want to say is, what makes a nation a Christian nation? Do they need to overtly say we are a Christian nation? Well, I would say if that's what we're looking for, we don't find our founders ever saying that directly. But what we do find is that they clearly identify with a Christian worldview as you go through the Declaration of Independence, as you go at the end of the Constitution. It's in the year of our Lord, 1787. They use the first person plural pronoun referring to the kingdom of Jesus Christ running through history. And so there is the clear evidence that the Christian faith has shaped the nation. Now, when you come to the case of the Treaty of Tripoli, what we do want to think about is this. There was an attempt to try to find some sort of a peace agreement with the Muslims. We've heard about the Barbary pirates that were hijacking American ships in the Mediterranean. And so there was an attempt to kind of bring a truce. And so there is this treaty called the Treaty of Tripoli that allegedly says that America signed on and said, we are not a Christian nation. Now, the problem with all of that, first of all, is that it didn't happen in Washington's leadership. So when Norman Lear went to go and say, okay, this happened, Washington signed it. Now, it was done under the Adams administration. So it's actually the
John Adams,
the, okay. the second president, not the first.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, when you go back into the diplomatic record, which, believe it or not, I've done this. I've gone back and looked at it.
You're the one.
You can't find that document officially signed. In fact, the people who've recorded it say there's total confusion about what the authentic document is at this point. So there are pieces that are written in by the, let's say, the Muslim representative that may or may not have been signed to by the Americans. So the legislative or the diplomatic record is absolutely confused. It's garbled. So,
wow.
So it's not even fully established.
You know, by the way, just a real quick aside, sometimes Christians get accused of, you know, coming up with these questionable quotes about the founding fathers or whatever. And but this is one that the people on the other side really hang their hat on, and you're saying it's one of those questionable quotes.
Well,
really questionable.
Yeah, well, so first of all, when they say Washington did it, that's not true. Secondly, when they say it's official, well, it may be official, but you cannot prove it by the record because the record is actually confused.
Wow.
And that's the footnote that they actually say in the record, as I saw the published record when I said, well, this is a pretty powerful argument. Thirdly, as you think about it, whether it was intended or not, when you're signing a document like this, when you're saying America is not a Christian nation, what would that have meant in this context? Would that have meant that the only thing we do in America is we require people who are in good standing and communion at a church that can be in government? Well, that's not true. So, in other words, there's no test of religion for the person who's the president of the United States. So if you have that as a part of our Constitution, you cannot declare yourself to be a Christian nation because you do not demand a Christian president. It doesn't mean you're not influenced and committed to Christianity. It just means that theoretically we are open to different believers or unbelievers at the helm of our nation, which is a fact. And then finally, I think also when I look at the constitutional record, we should remember that the last article, the Constitution, says the supreme law of the land is this Constitution. If it was intended to be a thoroughgoing Christian nation, it would have said the supreme law of the land is the Bible, Old and New Testament. Then we have never said that as a nation. But what we have done by making the supreme law of the land the Constitution, we still use the Bible and we take oaths. Yeah. We still recognize when people following the example of Washington saying, so help me God, with their hand on the Bible.
Which was the common way to do it.
It was a common practice. Yeah. So we are a Christian saturated culture. Our constitutional approach was designed to be Christian friendly, but it did not demand anyone to be a Christian to be the head of the country. So even if Adams really did sign that, what does it mean? What it means is what the Constitution says. And the Constitution says the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. You don't have to take a vow to Christianity or any test of religion to be our president. But we have a First Amendment that says Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So if you're a thoroughgoing Christian, welcome. You can be all you want as who you are in your government position because you have the freedom of conscience in our country. And that was the view of, I think, of our founders. We are Christian present, Christian influenced, but not mandated to be Christian. And this is where Jefferson was onto something when he spoke against the establishment of the Anglican Church in Virginia. He said, if you mandate a religion by the government, you will guarantee to make hypocrites.
Yeah.
People there just say, oh, I believe that. Well, you don't believe it. How about I got to believe it to get in government? I got to, so I can have my job.
Right.
So our founders, by not having a test of religion, were not moving away from Christianity. They were actually elevating their desire that people would be authentic in who they are. So you could say, I believe in God or I don't. Okay, well, if you don't believe in God, can you really be elected? And that becomes the debate. That's a much healthier place. And so it's Christian in character, but not Christian in mandate. So I like to say, our country was never established as overtly a Christian nation, but it was established as thoroughly influenced by Christianity, welcoming it and allowing it to have its full impact. So that's an important nuance. The Treaty of Tripoli would only be a small part of the case, and probably a very weak one at its very best.
When John Adams would have signed it, would he have seen in print, in English, those words?
That's part of the problem. We don't know what he...
We don't know for sure, even.
So here's
talk about questionable quotes.
Yeah, I think what we need to do is go back and look at the record. I have not seen the official final record. I have read the diplomatic record in print. And I was stunned to realize they say there's a lack of clarity as to what was what before when.
It's possible that maybe there was some Arabic writing there, and in that Arabic it said this is not a Christian nation
right.
or whatever. But
so in other words, it's not an open and shut case.
Yeah.
It's very confused by the very people who keep the records. That's what the footnote says.
Right. And part of the whole thing, though, too, is it was in dealing with Islam, the idea was to, even if they said, even if some founding fathers, I mean, I understand, by the way, Sidney Barlow was kind of more of a liberal founding father, and he was the one negotiating the Treaty of Tripoli. Even if he intended to say, well, we're not a Christian nation, that would be along the lines of saying to these Muslims, we're not at war with you, you know, in the way that, let's say, an expressly Christian nation would be at war with you because you've declared war against the Christians?
I think the answer would be they were saying, this is not a new crusade. We're not here to put the cross of Jesus Christ up in your land. We're here as a government that recognizes religious freedom, and we're not against Muslims per se. We're for our national rights, and we recognize your right to be who you are. So, I mean, it's really religious liberty is driving their way. They speak of themselves at that point.
And who is Sidney Barlow?
I don't remember his official position. He was an author, and he was in government at a lesser level. And I think in the Washington administration and on into the Adams administration.
Okay.
So he's in the diplomatic corps at some point.
And was he more liberal than...
Yes, I think he would have seen himself. He would have been exploring, I think, honestly, as you look at Barlow, as I recall, he was looking at more, maybe even looking at some atheistic literature. We don't know if he became an atheist, but you can find in his records he's looking at some more unbelieving positions. So he may have been less than a Christian.
Yeah.
He may have been a quiet deist. We don't know, but he's not really considered a founding father because he's later on in the process.
Oh, okay. Now, as far as the treaty going into effect, even if it did go into effect, I don't think the Muslims kept their side of the bargain because we had to go to the shores of Tripoli, right?
Yeah, we sing it in the Marine hymn. So Jefferson ended up saying we got to go back and fight. So one of the things, now we're getting into contemporary issues, but the issue with the jihad of the Muslims is this issue of there's Islam and then there's war.
Yeah, there's the house of peace and the house of
if it's not war. A Muslim country, you're automatically at war because you got to conquer that to make it Muslim, to be under Islam. So there, in other words, all that you can do, at least in the historic sense of the jihad, is you have to confront it because they're coming to fight. They're warriors. They're advancing their kingdom. That's the nature of their faith. So it's very, very difficult.
So when they say, for example, statements like Islam is a religion of peace, what they mean by that is Islam is a religion of peace for those who are submitting to Allah because you're at peace with Allah. But if you're not at peace with Allah, then the devout Muslim feels the obligation through, you know, jihad and because of their devotion to Sharia law, strict Islamic law, that they will make you do that. And if you don't, then maybe they'll even kill you thinking they're doing God a favor.
Okay, that's a special study in its own right, and I think the Muslim tradition recognizes the use of the sword as part of their advancing of their faith, including not telling the full truth if it's not necessary, also treating those who are not Muslims as second-class citizens, obviously keeping women at a much lower rate of equality than what we would see in America. They can be Muslims, but they do not have the same rights. So it's a very, very different system of ethics than what Christians have as we have had our Judeo-Christian heritage.
Bill Federer says that the reason Thomas Jefferson went and got a copy of the Quran was so that he could try and understand for himself by reading their own source documents and so forth, why they were at war with us when we were not at war with them. And then ironically, some of these Muslims, you know, swearing in, you know, to the allegiance to the Constitution, supposedly, they're swearing in some cases on Thomas Jefferson's Quran, but in reality, Jefferson got it so he could, you know, bone up on what's going on. Why are they attacking us without provocation?
Well, I don't know if you want to go down that path or not, but it's worthy of a very careful consideration as to how the truth is handled in Islam with non-Muslims, and also how you deal with people that have a different religious tradition under their control. Those are very sensitive matters. And back in that day, what we would call today moderate Muslims may have existed earlier, maybe in Spain. You have some examples. But in that northern part of Africa, it was much more, I think, of the jihadi type of we're fighting. And so why can you be a pirate and be a Muslim? Because you're attacking the non-Muslims.
Yeah.
They're not worthy of the rights. You can take what they have.
All right, now, let's explore something. What about the idea of founding fathers that were Christians early on and then later became more loosey-goosey in their faith? I think that would warrant a whole exploration, and we only have about 1 minute left. No, not even half a minute. So let's save that for another discussion, because I think that's a very worthy one.
I would say a good example just to consider is how did John Adams' faith develop? He was seemingly more of a traditional congregational Christian. Later, he begins to show more Unitarian beliefs, and he and Jefferson connect on Unitarianism. And that's part of the liberalizing that is beginning to take place after the American Revolution. I don't think we see that earlier in the history. It does begin to show up. So I'll finish with this. Some have said Unitarianism can be described as the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man, and the neighborhood of Boston. So that's where you have, if you will, the beginning of Unitarian thinking, and it begins to percolate out. And it does begin to link with more radical ideas over time. And then that's where the a more unbelieving enlightenment begins to take place. But that's worthy of another study.
Absolutely. ProvidenceForum.org for more information. Dr. Lilbeck, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry.